our main speaker for this evening from Orchid / Los Alamos, who just recently moved to Los Alamos, Suzanne. All right.
I'm Suzanne, I'm an alcoholic. Oh, wow. You know, I've done this probably 50 times and I still don't like it. It's an honor and a privilege to speak in Alcoholics Anonymous. It really is. Because I should be dead, you know? I mean, I look around this room and it's like, I bet there's a few of you that feel like that. You know, by the grace of God and the fellowship, I have gotten to stay sober pretty much since I got here. You know, and part of the joy of that is getting to see people come in and watching Arlene take her cake. It just, you know, she said, you watch me come in, and I'm thinking, oh yeah, I did, and this vision flashed through my head, and this woman, I gotta tell this story, this woman walks into a meeting, right, she's got this tight red dress on and this big red bow in her hair, and I had a few years, but I kept thinking, oh my God, who's the hooker? Right? It took me a long time to get any recovery in this place, right? She remembers. God, you know? I don't know. You know, I'd like to welcome the newcomers. It takes a lot to walk into Alcoholics Anonymous. It takes a lot out there, you know, it really does. I was beat up by alcohol. You know, I trashed myself out there. But I was so afraid to walk in here. You know, it's like I knew what was out there. But I just kept getting beat up and beat up and beat up. And I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous somewhere in March of 1989 with my mom. And my mother was an alcoholic, and she was very outgoing and bubbly, and, you know, she just liked to jump on the bandwagon with anything. So she knew I had a court card from a DUI that I got, and that I kept telling her I was going to meetings, but I kept coming home drunk. And part of the problem with that is there was like three bars and a couple of liquor stores between her house and the meeting here. So I would come home from the meeting, and she'd say, how was the meeting? And I'd say, well, you know, it wasn't that great. And, you know, I just stopped to have a few drinks. And she wasn't stupid, you know. But I also, back then I had to have 6 AA meetings. I don't know what people with the DUI have to have now. Probably like 175 or something. But I had my little green card. I had to get my 6 meetings. And I showed up to a meeting here, this meeting, the Sunday night speaker meeting. And Dan Kay, who's actually up on the board, he got up and he took a cake. I didn't know what was going on in this meeting. I'd never been to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what to expect. You know, if this is your first meeting, you know, it may all seem real bizarre to you that, you know. I mean, I walked in the meeting, you know, they asked for newcomers, people under 30 days, and my mom, you know, she's all on her bandwagon, and she's getting ready to raise her hand, and I tell her, shut up! Knock it off! Don't attract attention to us! You know? I mean, I just wanted to sit in the back and be cool, you know? And so he gets up and he takes a cake, and I don't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, and Dan had 6 years at that point, and he gets up and he says, I'm Dan, I'm an alcoholic, and I haven't had a drink in 6 years. And I thought, oh my God, these people don't drink at all. I can't be here, you know? And I mean, I just sat in the back and panicked the whole time. I looked around for the rules. I saw the steps, the traditions. I read them really fast to figure out how they were going to kick me out. Because I got 86 out of every bar in this town. And I was waiting, you know, and the speaker got up, and all I remember is his name was Roger. He wore goggles. I mean, maybe I was just still drunk, but he wore goggles, and he wrote children's books, and he wrote one called Mr. Rabbit Says the F Word. You know, and he talked a lot about drinking, and I thought, how am I supposed to stay sober when all you people do is talk about drinking? Right? And so I thought, well, you know, after the meeting, my mom says, well, you know, let's go home. And I said, well, I got a couple of stops to make before I go home, right? I got real thirsty in here, you know, and I wasn't done yet because it was right before St. Patrick's Day. And I used to go to O'Sullivan's Pub. And you can't really get sober right before St. Patrick's Day when you go to an Irish pub, right? I mean, that's just stupid. So I went to O'Sullivan's Pub. And one more time, I got 86th from there. And I went over to what's now, Louis B's. It was the Silver Dollar. And I went in there, made a big fuss, got myself kicked out of there. But long story short, at the end of the night, I ended up being arrested, completely trashing myself. And, you know, at some point when Lisa speaks, I got to hear her story, because the getting your dignity back, Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that. Because the things I did out there with the people that I hung out with, I had none of that when I got here. I had no self-respect. I had no dignity left. I was a shitty mom. And I absolutely hated my own guts. And I was afraid when I walked in here that if I looked you in the eye, you would notice. Normally, I don't get to this part, the ugly cry part of my story, until way at the end. So I'm going to kind of jump around so I don't have to do this anymore, because I don't see any tissues and, you know, doing this. I mean, you know, when I first got here, I could wing it, but now I got glasses, so, you know, what are you going to do? So needless to say, I don't drink like other people. I never have. Not from the first time I drank. I told you a little bit about my mom. My mom was an alcoholic. My parents divorced when I was 2, and I went to live with my mom. And I'm originally from down south in like Thousand Oaks, Oxnard. And the first time I drank, I drank at my mother. She was you're not an alcoholic if you drink after 5 o'clock at night. Only alcoholics drink before 5. You know, but there's the little caveat at the bottom that says some exclusions may apply. Like holidays, some weekends, if she had a party, you know, but that was her thing, is after 5, you can start drinking after 5. And I swear to God, she must have timed it, right? Because she got home at 5 from work, and she would pour her vodka and grapefruit juice. And she would start drinking and making dinner, and everything was fine. But after about an hour, everything went to hell in a handbasket. And it's like I'd walk in the kitchen, and, you know, there's things in the stove and the oven on fire, you know, like the rolls. She always had to have the whole meal, you know, the meat, the potatoes, the vegetables, and she always had to have rolls. Well, somehow the rolls always ended up these little charcoal briquettes. Because by the time dinner was done, it was over. You know, she was drunk, she was on the phone, she would forget about dinner. You know, and I joke about it, and it is funny looking back. I mean, and I get it. You know, I get that when we drink, that's really all we care about. You know, it isn't about the kids, it's not about anything else. So needless to say, growing up with a mom who was alcoholic, it got scary at times. And my mother was not abusive, and she wasn't hateful, and she wasn't any of that. She was more of the get drunk and get melancholy, and I just love you. I just love and adore you. And, you know, and being a kid and feeling like that's my security and I've got to take care of her, you know, so that I'll be okay. So when I was like, I remember being like 4 or 5 years old, having to carry her up the stairs to get her to bed, and she smoked. So it was always the cigarette like this and the drink going like this, and we're going up the stairs, right? And I would sit and I would watch her until she fell asleep, because she would drop the cigarette and it would roll underneath the bed. And that was before cigarettes actually put themselves out, you know. I remember every time we moved, there was like cigarette burns in the carpet all over the place. And the fact that the woman did not burn the house down is beyond me. But then I would lay in bed and I would listen for a while, and she would do a header into like the hamper going to the bathroom. So it makes you kind of hypervigilant, you know, and you've got to protect everything. We always had 2-story houses, and it was like, oh my God, can we just live on one floor so I don't have to panic every night, you know? The one night that I do remember is she had actually hired a housekeeper, and I was raised in like an upper middle class home. She had really good jobs. We lived in nice houses. We lived at the beach. You know, I was spoiled. I got whatever I wanted. And there was a lot of the guilt that went along with being an alcoholic mom, is you give your kids everything. And if you're sitting here tonight and you're newly sober and you're feeling guilty about your kids, just go buy them something. That doesn't work at all. Right? So, you know, she bought me anything I wanted. But there came one night, we had a housekeeper who raised me pretty much, who kind of took care of me and shielded me from a lot of that. But one night, I came downstairs for something. I was trying to find her, and she had fallen backwards in on her bar stool. We had bar stools, and she was on the phone and had her drink, and she fell backwards, and I couldn't wake her up. And I really tried to wake her up for quite a while. I was probably 4 or 5. And I went upstairs to Edna, the housekeeper, and she had passed out on the bed and had blood coming out her nose. And all I remember is I'm all alone, everybody's dead. That's all I remember. And the thing about alcoholism is that you can think that, go to bed, you wake up the next morning, people are making breakfast and they're doing the normal stuff and nobody talks about what happened the night before. It's like the big secret. So you learn that there's these secrets, right? And I had gotten so done with that over the years. By the time I was about 12, I decided that I'm going to start drinking. Back in the 70s, 80s, the big thing was having a fully stocked bar. And my mother used to have a lot of cocktail parties. You know, she'd have people over to the house and she always had booze. So I had my pick of whatever. Now, they talk in Alcoholics Anonymous about there being that invisible line that we cross where, you know, once you cross over it, you can't stop drinking. I did that at 12. You know, my first drink at 12, I don't think there was a line. I think the minute that I drank, I crossed that line. I went downstairs, I poured a tumbler of vodka about this much, and I chased it with like flat Diet Coke or something. And I remember drinking it, and you know how you take a big swig and you're like, okay, and you're waiting for it and nothing's happening. So you take another big swig and you're waiting for it and nothing's happening. And the next thing I know, I hear this banging on the door, and I'm like, what the hell? And we lived in this two-story house, right? And my mom's banging on the door. She says, you're going to be late for school. And I'm thinking, what the hell? I look down. I'm laying in a bathtub full of cold water. I have one roller skate on, flung over the side of the bathtub. I'm fully clothed. And I'm like, what the hell happened? And I had the worst hangover and the worst headache, and I didn't know what happened, and I thought, I am never going to do that again, right? Isn't that what we think? First time you have bad, it's like, oh my God, I'm never going to do that again. I don't know how this woman does this every night. And my mother was a functioning alcoholic. She would go to work every day and make dinner and burn dinner and whatever. I mean, but she had it together to where, you know, on the outside, everything looked great. And that was her big deal, is the outside needs to look good. So probably a week later, I thought, I got to learn how to do that better. Maybe I ought to not drink vodka and I'll drink something else. You know, where normal people, had they had that kind of a reaction to it, would have said, yeah, I'm not going to do this again, and maybe not drink for a few more years, especially at like 12. I mean, come on, right? By the time I was 13, I was raised in Christian schools. That's where I went to school, was Christian schools. So I was the only little alcoholic at the Christian school, coming to school with a hangover in Bible class, right? You know, it just got worse from there. It was like at 13 I would steal her beer and I would start going out, and if there wasn't anything in the house, I would go stand in front of the liquor store and get people to buy me beer. You know, 13-year-old girl out in front of the liquor store getting grown men to buy her alcohol. You know, that totally works. For any of you that are questioning, who would do that? Who would buy a 13-year-old girl alcohol? Everybody. Yeah. Most everybody would. The thing about it is that alcohol made all the bad stuff go away. Made all the feelings go away. It made everything go away. And it made me okay. Because the way I grew up, I wasn't okay. I was one of those little kids that I was afraid of everything. Everything. I was afraid of new things. I didn't like people. I didn't want to. I was just afraid of everything. And I was shy. And once I drank, that all went away. You know, and drugs are a part of my story. When I was 12, 13, I could go buy an ounce of weed quicker than I could get a beer. You know, so I spent like the majority of my teenage years drinking, partying, and it wasn't the normal, let's go have a couple of beers. It was, let's get drunk and die! You know, that kind of thing, right? Sex, drugs, and rock and roll, you know? And by the time there was high school, there was Nancy Reagan and her Just Say No. And it was like, oh, why didn't I think of that? That's so stupid, you know? So by the time I hit high school, I decided I was going to go to a public high school. I wasn't going to the Catholic high school they wanted me to go to because I'd already been through Lutheran, Baptist, generic Christian. She wanted me to go to a Catholic high school, and I thought, you know, I can't do this anymore. Neither one of my parents were religious, right? You know, so try and come home and talk to them about Jesus. They're like, yeah, whatever. And I'm thinking, I've been doing this for like 8 years, and you people aren't even on board with any of it. So I went to a public high school, and that's where everything just kind of crashed and burned. I didn't go to school. I cut class, hung out with the stoners.
Yeah.
Like, I lived at the beach, so everything was like, dude, totally, dude. I love you, man. So I never really fit in anywhere. I just didn't, and I always felt different. You know, we hear that in here. I always felt different, and I was different. When I was going to Christian schools, you know, people would invite, and it was okay having an alcoholic mom until your Christian friends invited you over to their house to spend the night, right? And there's mom and dad, and they're having dinner, and nobody's drinking, and it's kind of weird, and they kind of pay attention to each other and do all the normal stuff. That's when I knew I was different. Nobody's parents were divorced. I mean, this was back in the 70s, and divorce wasn't as common as it is now, you know. So by the time I was 15, I decided, you know, I need to go up the food chain a little bit. I think I'm going to start hanging out with bikers. Because if I'm going to get into bars, I need some big guy to help me get into bars, right? What better way to go than go to biker bars? So I hooked up with this guy, and, you know, he could buy, which was important. I mean, you know, if they had a job and they were over 21, you're mine. Right? You know, and in the meantime, I trashed myself. From the time I was 13 years old, I trashed myself. I was a blackout drinker. I was a blackout throw-up drinker. I was a lose my bra everywhere I went. I don't know what happened to all those bras. I just stopped wearing them. Right? I mean, if you lose your bra like 4 times, you're like, forget it. Don't even need one. Took me 2 years in recovery to wear a bra. Yep, feeling like I'm more closer to y'all now, so we can start sharing this part. My mother used to ask me all the time, what do you want to be when you grow up? What are you going to do with the rest of your life? And for a child that's like 5 or 6 or 10 or whatever, that's a big question, and I never had an answer. And I got with this guy, and we hung out at Hell's Angels rallies, and we went to concerts. And before that, I was hitchhiking to concerts down in LA by myself with my girlfriends and stuff. And that was back when you could hitchhike, and you know, you didn't necessarily have to die. We came really close a few times, and we met some really sketchy people. And there was times when we had to threaten people and mace a couple of people and do some pretty gnarly things to get out of there. And you know, I mean, I ended up down at Capitol Records one time with this guy who had taken me and my friends down to LA, and decided that he told us he was going to pimp us out after he bought us alcohol. And we ended up having to hit him with a beer bottle and jump out and hitchhike back. You know, that was just like your typical, like, Friday afternoon. You know, some of the scare. I should be dead. I should have been murdered and raped and murdered and thrown in a broccoli field somewhere. You know, really. So I get with this guy, and he's got a cocaine problem. And we decide that I end up pregnant right before my 18th birthday. I did manage to graduate from high school. That was my big deal, right? My mom said, what do you want to do with the rest of your life? And when she found out I was pregnant, I said, I'm going to have a baby. That's what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. Now, mind you, I had never even held a baby or hung out with kids or cared at all about children. But how hard could it be, right? And I remember looking at my mom and going, I could do this. women have been squatting in fields having kids forever. I mean, you know, it's like a pet, right?
Like a pet.
I mean, you feed it, and you change it, and you're good to go. You know, not to mention that I had alcoholism on top of it, and I was with a guy who had a cocaine problem, but boy, we were going to be a family, and we were going to... picket fence, and you know, and we ended up in a studio apartment with his motorcycle in the living room, and he's got his drug problem, and he's running off stealing my car and my money, and I'm busy throwing his shit out in the lawn and doing all that drama, and if you loved me, you wouldn't do this, and you know, I mean, I qualify for a lot of programs, but Al-Anon was one I should have, you know, maybe looked a little more into. You know, so we had this beautiful little red-haired girl, and my mother bought us a condo in Newbury Park, and we moved in, and that was going to be our, you know, white picket fence, you know. And his drug addiction got worse. I actually had toned my drinking down quite a bit. But he ended up getting sick right after our daughter was born. And nobody could figure out what was wrong with him. They finally figured out he had subacute bacterial endocarditis. And I know that because I went through it for 2 years with him. And that's where a bacteria attaches to your heart and eats away the valve. And it's from it shooting drugs. So he was like 28 and he had his valve replaced. And I would go down to the hospital every day and take my baby and go down to the hospital every day. And I finally got to the point where I can't do this anymore. You know, I was working part-time and trying to take care of my daughter. And I finally, my mother said, I know, how about if I move you to Santa Maria? And I'm like, where's that? And she goes, it's up north. I really like it up there. And I'm like, okay, you know, because why not? What else have I got going for me? Nothing. So I leave him down there to do his thing and... we come up here, and I came up here in 1987. My mother liked it up here, and she wanted me to go to school, and so I enrolled in Hancock, and I became a welder, and my alcoholism just continued to get worse. But there was a part of me that thought, you know what, if I move up here, I can get rid of all those people down there, all those bad influences, and I'll stop drinking. Well, the minute I moved in, there was a back neighbor who was 21, and the day I moved in, I went and had him get me a 12-pack, and he was kind of my bitch after that. This poor guy, I swear to God. Because at some point, he wanted to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he kept trying to get me to go to meetings. I'm like, no, but if you can pick up a 12-pack on your way to the meeting and bring it back to me, I'm fine. The funny thing is I've continuously seen this man in Alcoholics Anonymous in Arroyo Grande for years, you know? And he'll have like 10 years and then he'll have two. And I mean, he goes back and forth, but I'm like, oh my God, you know? By the time I got here, my daughter's father had died. And I had wanted to just drink myself to death. I couldn't go a day without drinking, and it made me want to die, pretty much. I mean, bottom line, it made me want to die. I drank every day. And to try and take care of a baby and drink, and I remember when I was a kid, I would tell myself, if I ever have a kid, I'm never going to treat her like that, you know? And we had moved into this house over by the bar over there. And I picked the house probably because it was by O'Sullivan's and then Louis B's. And there was a couple of liquor stores. And I didn't even have to get in my car to drive to, you know, do that. And I told myself, and this was when I was trying to control my drinking. I told myself, okay, tonight I'm just going to have a six-pack. And I'm going to make dinner. And we're going to watch a show. And I'm going to be a good mom. And I went and I got the six pack and I had two beers and I blacked out and I wake up and I'm freezing and I'm laying on the couch and I'm covered in a little pink blankie and my daughter's laying next to me on the floor shivering. And I flash back to my mom on the bar stool and I thought, how long did she try and wake me up? How long was I laying there? And I'd like to tell you that that brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous. It didn't. It was just one of those pieces of myself I gave away. Because when we're out there, we give these pieces of ourselves away. And it didn't take long after that. It was about a month after that that I walked into my first meeting with my mother and left. And after I got arrested at O'Sullivan's Pub for drunk in public, I had already had a DUI. I was coming down the Conejo Grade, and I was in a blackout, and I was heading for the cliff, and these people started honking their horns, and I got pulled over and got put under citizen's arrest. And that's how I got the DUI, and I was willing to do all the other stuff. I'll go to Central Coast Headway, I'll do all this bullshit for you and whatever, but and I did it all, and I paid the fine, and I still had this court card, and I didn't want to come in here because what if it didn't work? What if Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work? And then on the flip side of that is, what the hell is going to happen if it does work? I don't know how to not drink. You know, I don't know how to not drink. So the Sunday after St. Patrick's Day, I came into a meeting. And I sat over there against the wall and I listened. And there was this woman sitting in front of me and she was... I looked around the room, and it's like the room changed and the people changed from the meeting that I was at before. I wasn't looking for the differences anymore. I was listening because I was hoping you were going to save my life. And what I heard was a bunch of nonsense that didn't make any sense at all. You know, they kept talking about how and how it works and honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And there was this nice lady in front of me and all these nice people and they smelled good and they looked good. And I thought, here I am in my tank top and my jeans and my flip-flops and I got no bra on and fuck, right? And prior to coming to this meeting, after I'd been arrested and I woke and I came to in my house and my mom had my daughter and I'm sitting on the floor and I'm thinking, I just want to die. And I thought, I'm just going to stab myself to death, right? Because that sounds like a great way to kill yourself, right? I mean, how many times you got to stab yourself to, you know? And all I could think was, God help me. And I hadn't believed in God in years. And I said it out loud, God help me. And something propelled me off the floor. And I went into the kitchen. I opened up the junk drawer. And I pulled out the meeting schedule that I had gotten from the meeting. And I don't consciously remember it being in there, but I walked in and I sat down and I listened. And the lady sitting in front of me was, her name was Mary, and she was from Texas, and she had this nice accent, and she's just so nice. And here I am all biked out in my Harley tank top and shit, and I'm looking at her and I'm thinking, what the hell have you ever done? You know, what do you know about me? And then I hear, the newcomer's the most important person in the room. And I'm thinking, well, okay, I'm pretty important, right? So after the meeting lets out, I'm waiting for people to come up and, you know, show me how important I am. Not that I raised my hand or anything. And everybody left. And I was sitting out on the picnic table out there and... this one man was out there, this little old guy, and his name was Monty, and he came up and he started talking to me, and he told me a couple of things, and one of them was, I want to see you at the meeting tonight, which is this meeting, I want to see you at the meeting at 7 o'clock tonight, and I want you to be here, and he told me, you get with the women in this program, you watch out for the men in the program, right, and you get a sponsor that has 2 years or more. And I said, okay. And he said, do you think you can stay sober until midnight tonight, just for today? And I said, I don't know. And he said, can you stay sober until 6 o'clock tonight? Because I want you at the meeting at 6. And it was noon. And I said, okay, maybe. And he said, okay. And of course I come to the speaker meeting, and it's that Mary lady, and she's so nice, and she's talking, and you know, and I'm thinking, fuck! And God was there that night because she told my story. She told my story. And she was a heroin addict and a prostitute. I wasn't a prostitute or a heroin addict, but... the thing that got me? No, I wasn't. That was Arlene. girling. No, but her husband had died, and right before he left the house, she said, "I wish you were dead," and he wrecked his motorcycle into a telephone pole and died. And the night that that Danielle's dad died, I didn't know. I had said to a friend of mine, I said, "You know, I wish he'd just die. He's putting his family through so much pain." And that was the night he died. And that was the connection that Mary and I had. And Mary came up to me after the meeting, and I just stood there. And she came up and she hugged me. And I didn't know what to do. Swear to God, she came up to hug me. And I don't know if you newcomers, you notice how we hug everybody. It's like, "Oh my God, get off me. What do you want?" Right? And I think I stood there like this. I mean, I didn't know what to do. It's awful. And she gave me her phone number. She said, "You call me, even if it's at 2 o'clock in the morning." And she asked me about my drinking, and she said, "Do you think you can stay sober just for today? All you got to do is make it to midnight." I said, "Okay." And she became my first sponsor. That little lady that I thought was so nice and everything. That woman taught me more about Alcoholics Anonymous and spirituality in the first 4 months of my sobriety than anybody has since, really. She told me to break it down to an hour at a time if I had to. She told me to pray every morning for God to keep me sober. And I told her, I said, "You know what? I don't believe in God." And she said, "I don't give a shit." She said, you do it anyway. It works whether you believe it or not. And most of the stuff she told me to do I thought was stupid, but I did it anyway just so I could call her back and go, "That was dumb and it didn't work." Rarely did I ever call Mary back and say, "That was dumb and it didn't work." I mean, I was just a whack job when I first got here. I was crazy as hell. I did. I called her at 2 o'clock in the morning just to see if she'd answer the phone. I figured you were all full of shit, I gotta tell you. You know, "Oh, just call me anytime." "All right." "Yeah, okay. You just wait." And I would call her every morning, and I swear to God, I didn't know what to do with my life when I was new. You know, it was like I wake up in the morning and I'd be like, "Okay, I'm awake. Now what?" She'd be like, "You know, get in the shower, go to a meeting." "Okay." You know, some mornings I'd call her, I'd just be all bent out of shape about something like, "Oh my God, my life is falling apart. They didn't come and they didn't pick up my trash and da da da," you know, and I'm going off about something dumb, right? And she's like, "Okay, have you heard of HALT? Don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired." I'm like, "I'm fine, you're not listening. I have real problems today." And she'd be like, "Suzanne, how much coffee have you had?" I'd be like, "Well, I just drank the last pot and I'm making another one." She's like, "Did you even eat breakfast?" "No. You are not listening to me." You know? I had to learn how to function. I really did. And I didn't know anything about staying sober. And I walked in here and back then there was only 2 meetings a day. And they were at noon and at 8 o'clock at night. And I would come to both of them. And I would come would come an hour before the meeting. This club was open all the time. I got sober here. I don't know if I mentioned that, but I got sober here, and I would come an hour before the meeting, and I would sit. And because I knew this room was safe. This is a safe place, for those of you that don't know that. As long as you're sitting in this meeting, it is really unlikely that you're going to drink. And I knew that. I thought, as long as I'm in this meeting, as long as I sit in this room, I'm safe. So I would stay an hour before the meeting, and then I would stay after the meeting, and then for some reason after 9 o'clock at night, we'd all go to coffee. I don't know how the fuck I function with as much coffee as I drank all day long, and then we're going to go to coffee, you know? The people in Alcoholics Anonymous are some of the most incredible people you will meet in your life. And then there are some of the sickest people in the world in these rooms. And it can be the same person at any given time. Right? Those of you that have been around know that. You know, I have been the most spiritual beacon in Alcoholics Anonymous at times, and then I've been the sickest person in the room. And you know the only thing worse than being the sickest person in the room is everybody knows it but you. Right? And I've done both. You know, I came in and I worked the steps. And at 4 months of sobriety, Mary was looking at taking a six-year cake, and she drank again. And then tried to tell me, you know, I'm not an alcoholic and all this stuff. And I was angry. And what that forced me to do was to reach out to other women in the program. I learned how to pick up the phone and go, I'm not okay. And women in this program surrounded me. They said, come to my house. Bring your daughter. Bring your daughter. You know, I used to call Mary all the time and go, I really want to drink. I really want to drink. And she'd go, bring your daughter over. Just come over and we'll have coffee. And after about 10 times of that, she goes, bring your daughter over. Come over. And I went over and she met me out at the curb. She goes, I'm taking your daughter. You can either go to a meeting or you can drink. I don't give a shit. This is your recovery. This is not my recovery. You're going to have to want this at some point, Suzanne. And bingo, the light went off. And I thought, oh my God, this is my recovery. You know? And I was told to treasure this because it's a gift. I don't play with my recovery. I never have. I don't drink near beer. I don't smoke near weed. I don't smoke near weed. I don't snort near cocaine. And trust me, if that was available, I would have thought about it when I was new. Because I'm back in the cocaine generation, all you meth heads that are out there, right? I got to tell you, you know what, if you're new in this program and you're hurting and you're not understanding what's going on and you don't think you can do this, welcome to the club. Welcome to the club. I sat in here, people took bets on me because I was so angry when I got here. I would sit in the corner over there and with my buck knife and I'd clean my nails. And I'd have my daughter, who was three, running up and down these chairs, and they were all metal chairs at the time. And she would just, it was like, oh my God. You know, that's why I love to see kids in meetings, because I brought my daughter to a meeting. So for any of you people that sit in meetings and like, do your thing while there's kids in the meeting, like, ha, can't see that, ha. You look across the meeting at me and you will see me giving you a look. You will. Because I had to bring my daughter. I didn't have any other choice at all. And had you given me a look or said one thing about my kid, I would have left and died. I didn't have anybody out there. I raised her by myself. And, you know, I was so unfunctional when I got here. I really was. I was angry all the time. And that took time to go away. And my first year was hard. I wanted to drink all the time. It was my only option. It was like, okay. And then when I found God, right, when I finally started talking to the big spook when I was doing the second step, okay, you big spook, if you're up there, give me a sign that I'm not supposed to drink. I would do shit like that. And then I would go to the liquor store. I remember I had 6 months sober, and I thought, you know what? I didn't get sober to feel like this. This is stupid. So I went and I got a 12-pack. I set it on the thing, and I'm like, okay, God, if you don't want me to drink, give me a sign. And there was no sign. And I opened up a beer and I cracked it. And I remember Mary telling me, you know, the shortest prayer you can say is, God, help me. And I knew where I was going if I drank that beer. And I said, God, help me. And I laid back on the couch and I fell asleep. It was the middle of the day. And when I woke up, I thought, oh, crap, I got to go pick my daughter up from school. And the obsession to drink had gone. So I poured that 12-pack down the drain. And that happened one more time. And the minute I cracked the beer, the phone rang and it was my sponsor. And by the time I got off the phone with her, I didn't want to drink anymore. And if you're new in this program, it is the little things you do. It's the actions you take. It's not what you think. Because if I did everything and I had to wait for my feelings, you know, I want to feel like I want to do that. No, screw that. You're going to get loaded. I had to take the actions and then the feelings followed. Yep. You know, the women in this program taught me that. You suit up, you show up, you tell the truth. Even if it makes you look bad. I've had to sit in these rooms with almost 6 years of sobriety and tell people, you know what? If I stay sober a week, I'm going to have 6 years of sobriety. I don't give a shit. I want to go get loaded. I want to take you with me. Right? Because I get gnarly. I mean, you know, I learned how to be nice in this program, but there's still that part of me. I mean, you can see it. It's coming back, right? I want to take you with me. You know, this is not a program that you do once and you stop. It's not. You don't get to the 12th step and people give you a trophy and they're like, congratulations, you're great, you know? This is something that we do on a daily basis. And when, in my first 5 years, I was doing so good and got so many pats on the back, I thought, yeah, right? Huh, I'm doing good. Pretty soon, I was sitting in meetings. I wasn't hearing what you were saying. I was busy looking at your hair like, what's going on over there with you? Listen to him talking out his neck. What the hell is she doing? He's sleeping with everybody. What's going on, you know? So I pretty much unworked the steps, right? And then I found myself just funky as hell. And believe it or not, these steps work no matter how many times you work them, you know? So I got back into the steps. And I re-upped my program, you know. You don't have to go down the fucking rabbit hole as far as some of us have gone. If you're sitting in this room and going, I've never done that, you know, I just got drunk at that PTA meeting, made a fool of myself. I don't know why I'm here. You're fine. You know, for those of you that are in here wondering if you're an alcoholic, I'll give you give you a little piece of advice. People that aren't alcoholics don't usually show up to Alcoholics Anonymous. So you might have a drinking problem. Just the fact that you're sitting in this room. You know? This is the greatest program in the world. And I look at people that drink normally and have all these problems and they have no solution. We have a solution here. You know, we do. I haven't found it necessary to take a drink in, well, shit. Friday, this April 6th. I'll have 29 years of sobriety. Wow. And I haven't done everything right, but I've worked the first step. That's the only step you've got to work perfectly. That's the only one I've worked perfectly. I mean, I've done things in Alcoholics Anonymous that I am so not okay with. They seemed like a good idea at the time, is really all I can tell you, but had I had it to do over again, I certainly wouldn't have done that, you know, or them, or her, or him, or whatever. Jesus. You know, God. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has showed me how to be a friend, how to be a sponsor, how to be a mom, you know? I mean, I didn't totally trash my daughter. I mean, maybe a little. You know, and that's my biggest blessing, is that I get to be here for other people, whether it's my family, whether it's you, you know? I get to sponsor people. You know, they tell me their stuff. I mean, if you got any idea of how gnarly I was and how just ugly and nasty I was, imagine people coming to me to tell me their problems. Like I would care, right? I didn't give a shit about you when I got here. I didn't care. You know, today that is the bright spot of my life, is to be able to sponsor the women and the men in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have sponsored men, which is a whole different thing. It's kind of cool. But, you know, it was stress that I get into service when I was new, and I think that's the reason I stayed. The first year, I had so many commitments. We had a hotline. I was answering that to these drunk broads at 2:30 in the morning who didn't really want to get sober, just wanted a wine to me. I was secretary in a meeting where only four people showed up, and it was a book study, a step study, and I had the least amount of sobriety, and it was like I just showed up. We used to clean ashtrays. This place would be filled with smoke right now, and the ceilings were like orange, and I just, you know, I cleaned the ashtrays. I washed the coffee cups. My first year, I did what I was told to do because my ideas weren't working anymore. You know, my best thinking almost got me killed multiple times. And I came in here, and I wondered how to do this program, and how I did it was I listened to you, and I did stupid things, even though I didn't believe it would work. I'd be all twacked out calling my sponsor like, oh, my God! And she'd go, Suzanne, I want you to go clean your bathroom and call me back. What? Go clean my bathroom, call her back. It worked. It worked. You know what? And if you stay sober, you're going to walk through some shit. You'll walk through normal life problems, and they would happen whether or not you're sober. But when you're sober, you get to show up. You get to show up for other people. You know, I mean, I've lost people in this program. I've watched people die in this program who didn't need to, but for some reason, they had to go back out and try it again. You know, I've been to more funerals than weddings here, you know. But I've had some awesome experiences, you know. If you're new, keep coming back. Show up to meetings. Just do it. Try not to drink between meetings. If you do, keep coming back anyway. You know, if you're sitting here today and you're like, I don't know about this program, but boy, he's kind of cute. I think I'll come back to the next meeting and see if he's there. Do it. Do it. Whatever gets you to a meeting. You know, one of my sponsors, Pam, used to tell me, whatever gets you to a meeting, you know, doesn't matter why you're here. You know, my life has gotten so awesome today because of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I so did not want to show up here tonight. I really didn't. You know, that little red-haired girl that I had is sitting right there. And I've never spoken in front of her, and I hope she's not completely humiliated by the time I sit down. But what the hell? People that know me know I don't care. So, I don't know. You know, I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I really am. And thanks, Glenn, for asking me to leave.